whole impetus for tonight is, I think, incredibly inspiring response to try to find meaning from a tragedy. And I can't think of any more fitting way to try to respond constructively to an incredible tragedy by going to the heart of a meaningful response, which is to talk about parenting, to talk about how to inspire our children and raise our children. And limit setting is very much a part of that challenge. So what I'll do is I'll talk for a little while, and then probably the more meaningful part will be the discussion. That's where people keep me honest, and that's where we'll get to be more tachlis oriented. Okay? So let me start with a couple of basic thoughts on limit setting. It's interesting. There's an incredible Gemara. I think it's three times in Shas from what I've been able to see, although in a Brisa and Smachos it's repeated also. And it's talking about parenting. And it talks about raising children, famous Gemara. The key is to find the balance between small docha v'mim karevas. It's the balance between love and limits. And it's fascinating that thousands of years later, as psychologists do research on what optimal parenting is, what they came up with after a lot of years of research, a psychologist at Berkeley, showed pretty definitively in large-scale research that what happens if you are all love, no limits. She calls it an overindulgent parenting style. All yeses, no nos. We raise an overindulged, spoiled kid, okay? It's perhaps the biggest challenge of today's generation of parents is how do you find the strength to put limits on kids. Most parents now are specialists on the Yemim HaKarevet and have more difficulty with small docha. Okay. If it's all limits and no love, that's called an authoritarian parenting style, and that's associated with delinquency and rebelliousness. Rules without relationships equals rebellion. You need to have flexibility. You need to find a balance in terms of that middle style of parenting, which is called authoritative parenting. Which is exactly what Chazal tell us about small dochid mimikarevas. And there's an incredible imagery put out by Rav Simcha Wasserman. Rav Simcha Wasserman, the son of Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who had never had children of his own, but had incredible insights into parenting. He always told people who knew him well that his insights into parenting came from, he was always able to put himself into the, he had perspective on the parenting style, on the perspective of kids. But he says the following, he said a brilliant insight. He says, what happens if you take a child, you go home tonight, and let's say your kids didn't fall asleep. Let's say your husband's didn't do such a great job in putting them to sleep. Let's say they don't know how to say no so well. And let's say you go home, and as your kid comes out to greet you, you put into play what the Gemara says, and you push your child away with the left hand while simultaneously bringing them closer with the right hand. What happens? You turn them around. It's a great imagery. He says, how do you turn a child around? You find that balance between small docha and makarevas. Now, let me talk about it because it's. I'm going to give you some specific practical guidelines, but first I want to set the stage a little bit because you can't understand limit setting out of the context of understanding the left hand and the right hand. You need to really understand that. So let me start just a drop on a drop on the limit setting side. And I'll tell you a, I guess, medrash, and then a story, and then I'll do the same thing with the left hand also. So let's start with the right hand also. Left hand medrash and stories. Pasuk and Mishle, okay? It says, this is on limit setting. It says, Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva, the el hamiso al tite nafshech, which means put limits on your kid, there's always hope. And don't pay attention to their screaming and yelling. Incredible insight. What insight, right? Incredible pasuk, right? You put limits on your kid, there's always hope. And don't pay attention to their yelling and screaming. Now listen to the medrash on this pasuk, because it's so, when I first saw this medrash, it hit me, wow. This really falls foreign to modern ears. But when you think about it, you see the amazing wisdom. Listen to the medrash. The medrash says the following. Kol hamosif av yisurim al bino, mosif haben ahava al aviv. I'll say it again. Right? Kol hamosif av yisurim al bino, the more a father puts limits on his children, okay, that's what it means in this context, okay, Mosif haben ava lovis. You might say, whoa, what does that mean? You mean love comes from limit setting? Is that what your kid does when you say no to them? They probably tantrum. They probably go nuts on you. They probably scream. They probably yell. And yet, with incredible insight, the Medrash tells us that that's actually the instrument of love. Deep down, the kid knows, and deep down, the kid appreciates it. I'll tell you a story, but before the story, I'll just tell you, I'll share with you three experiences in my practice. I've practiced child clinical psychology for about 30 years, okay, at a hospital in the New York metropolitan area, but also had a private practice, and I saw a lot of kids over those years. And on three occasions, the following thing happened, at least three, might have been four. I'd have an adolescent in my office, and the parents would be putting limits on the adolescent. They'd be saying, no, you know, you have to come back by such and such a time from going out Motzei Shabbos, or no, you can't have internet in the house, or no, to whatever it is the kid wanted. And the kids would go nuts, often in my office. You know, you're the only parent in the whole world who says, no, all my friends are allowed to do this. I haven't met that friend. Maybe that friend lives in Waterbury, I don't know. But they always talk about the friend. All my friends are allowed to do it. Okay? So kid goes nuts in my office, constantly, fighting off the left hand of small docha. Okay? And then the next generation comes in. Okay? The kid grows up. Okay? The kid gets married, has children, brings the next generation into my office. I've had that happen quite a bit. Okay? Be very careful about telling your children. I just hope one day you have children that grow up to be just like you, because it often happens. Okay? Be careful. Okay? So, they bring the kid, and you're not going to want it. As a grandfather, I can tell you this. You're not going to want it with your grandchildren. With your children, that's one thing, but not with your grandchildren. So, three occasions, I've had these now adults come in with their children, and they told me spontaneously, remember in your office 15 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever it is, I was going nuts because my mother or father had those rules, and they were saying no to me, and they were putting limits on me, and I was screaming and yelling. Deep down, I was so happy they were doing it. Even then, I knew it consciously. I needed to yell, I needed to scream, I needed to push back. But, kol hamosif av yisurim al bino, mosif haben ahava al aviv. Okay? So that's that. And now I'll tell you a concluding story on this section of the small docha of limit setting. It's an incredible story because of, and it won't be surprising, but it's interesting. It was a set of parents who had a very hard time saying no. They had a very hard time saying no. They were great at loving their kid. They just didn't know how to say no. And they lived in a very affluent neighborhood. And they were wonderful parents, but they just didn't. Every time their kid fetched, they said yes, and they gave in. And it started to create a little bit of a monster. And the kid was getting more and more out of hand. More and more out of hand. To the point that I was very nervous. Because he was telling me in my office privately that he was doing this, he was doing that. He was sneaking out of the house late at night. He was going on the internet and IMing his friends without the parents even knowing that he was on the internet. And he was going 2, 3 in the morning out to the neighborhood there and getting together with kids. And he was doing stuff that was getting, and I don't scare easily, okay? But I was getting nervous. So finally I tell him, look, I'm worried about you. I have to get your parents in here. We have to figure out what to do with this. So the parents come in, and I have a session with the parents and the kid. And the parents realize, and I helped show them, you have to balance the love with the limits. You have to balance the Min Makarevis with the Smol Docha. And they started reading the kid the Riot Act, just like I was talking about before. And they said, you know, from now on, you have to be back on such and such a time every night. And you're not allowed to, you know, go on the internet. We're password protecting it more than it had been before. And we're taking away this privilege and that privilege till you show that you're... And as they're doing it, he's getting more and more angry. He's turning all kinds of colors. He's screaming and yelling to the point that I was worried that he was going to hit his father. I was really worried because he was like it was spiraling out of control. So I asked them to wait outside because I wanted to calm them down and talk to him in a little bit of a calmer way. So they go out to my waiting room, and when he's sure that they're out of earshot, he calls me over and he whispers to me and he says, "It's about time." Okay? It's about time. So, true story. By the way, the end of the story, it's an amazing end of the story. The end of the story is that it almost sounds like a made-up end, but I was at a camp visiting day, and visiting one of my kids in camp a few years back, and I see the father, who I hadn't seen for many years, is going to visit his grandchildren, it turns out, and he points to me this young, bearded father who's going to visit his kids. And he says, "You don't remember him?" I said, Who? He says, "This is so-and-so." I said, "What?" And the end of the story is that he became a Kiruv Rebbe. And he's evidently a very effective Kiruv Rebbe in Yeshiva and Eretz Yisrael. He understands kids who are alienated because he had been there himself. And it's an amazing thing to see that you just sort of see when, like the Gemara tells you, when you get the balance between the Smol Docha v'Min Makareves, it's amazing. It's not often things aren't that simple, but that's on that end. Okay, so in terms of effective limit setting, though, here's the key. I'll say it again: rules without relationships equals rebellion. You can't set limits out of the context of a good relationship. So let me talk a little bit about the Min Makareves. What that has to do is we're very good at loving our kids. We're not so good in terms of the demands of this door, this generation, at the time thing. We're not so good at the time thing. And that's the key. The key to effective limit setting is your child will be much more likely to listen to you if you deliver your limits with love and calmness and in the context of spending as much time with them as you can. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that if your child knows that you're always distracted and you're not there for them, at least some of the time, the research shows a direct linear correlation between time spent with the child and the efficacy of limit setting. So, in a famous study that many of you have probably heard, done at Columbia, they find that every night a week the parents spend having dinner with their children, there's correspondingly lower risk of that child being at risk for drug abuse. Okay? as you go through that dynamic. Okay. Of course, there's never any guarantee with anything. You know, the Gemara tells us that in raising children, just like Parnassa, it's partly, totally in mazel. Okay. But in terms of what's in our control, there is a time limit setting connection that is shown over and over and over again, and that's in our control. Let me tell you two impediments. I'll tell you a story about the time issue. Okay? Story number one. My grandson comes in to visit from Eretz Yisrael when he was last summer, 3 years old. Okay? He brought my daughter and son-in-law with him, but that was sort of peripheral. It's my grandson. And I hadn't been at the park for a whole generation. My kids had aged out. And I was all excited that I get to go to the park again. I get to be a kid again. So I schlepped the poor kid to the park. I don't think he even wanted to go. He didn't know what it was. And I take him to the park, and I hadn't been in the park for a generation. And I go, and I'm walking into the park. And I see a scene that really was strikingly different than I had ever seen before. The scene is 10 fathers on the 10 swings of the park pushing their children this Sunday morning on the park. They're little kids. And I think to myself, how wonderful. Fathers are more actively involved this generation than in my generation. What a terrific sign. And I take my grandson over to the swings to wait his turn and going on a swing. And you know what I see? What I see, audiovisual aid, in every ear, a Bluetooth. In every ear, a headphone. So the fathers are there, but they're not there. They're there, but they're not there. I once heard Shmuel Kamenetsky say, who I've had the privilege of sharing many a shtender with on various programs in different neighborhoods. I once heard him say that he answers cell phones in Philadelphia Yeshiva. This is before they were internet-enabled. Because he says, when you have a cell phone in the Philadelphia Yeshiva, you're not a Talmud of the Philadelphia Yeshiva. Your body may be there, but your mind's not there. Because at any point, you could be pulled away. And it's an amazingly important kind of thing to think about. So that's point number one on time. I could bore you with statistics, but I'll tell you the statistic I heard not too long ago that really hit me. And it's my wife's a lawyer at a large law firm in Manhattan. And they had a retreat. And at the retreat, they were going over some statistics for the firm. And as they're going over statistics for the firm, the head of the firm announces, here's an interesting little statistic. The lawyers in this firm, it's a large firm, so you don't, it may not sound close, but it's the lawyers, the firm as a whole, we get 1 million pieces of email a week. 1 million pieces of email a week. Could you imagine what that means? That flood of information that you just go on overload with that. My father heard this, and he's a Rav, and he actually, keeping in the family tradition, actually founded the day school, and the Yeshiva Day School is one of Rav Mendelovich's Talmidim, founded the day school in Hartford, and then was a Rav for many years at the White Show. We wrote a book together called Balanced Parenting, from a Torah and psychological perspective. And he said on this, he said, it's an age of information without knowledge, communication without connection. Think about that. We're living in an age of information without knowledge, communication without connection. And those are horrible impediments to being able to effectively set limits with our children. The ingredient of the Yemin Mekareves is time, where the child knows you're really there. It doesn't mean you could be there with them if you're pulled in a million different directions all the time, but at least sometimes that there's nobody else but you and them together, with you seeing them seeing you, and they're seeing reflected back in your eyes true attention and true love. I'm not saying you don't have the love, but if you're constantly being distracted, it's just it could be incredibly, incredibly difficult. Beautiful Kutzker. Listen to this Kutzker. He says on a pasuk at the end of Tehillim, it says, Kachitzim biyad gibar kein b'nei hanurim. It's comparing chinuch habanim, raising children, to being an archer. So the Katzkuri asks, what's the connection between being an archer and raising children? And he says, an obvious connection. He says, just like with an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes. So too with our children, the closer we hold them to our heart, the further and straighter they go. Okay? And that's something rather obvious, but I'll make the obvious maybe more concretely obvious. If you have a terrific relationship and it's forged with time and forged with just being there, sharing your values and connecting to them that way to the extent that you can. And maybe we could talk later in the discussion about how to steal time. We'll talk about that. But if you have that, then doesn't it make sense that when you ask your child to do something and they're not being compliant, okay? That's a big problem with kids the age of most of your children. It's non-compliance. You ask them to do something and they don't do it. They're much more likely to listen to you if they feel that connection forged through time. They're going to want to because it's, again, rules without relationships equals rebellion. It just makes sense. Think about the best boss you ever had and the worst boss you ever had. Usually, I take the time to get a discussion going on that. I ask people, what's the characteristic of the best boss? Best boss is usually, they'll say, it's somebody who believed in me. It's somebody who spent time showing me how to do what I needed to do for my job. It's somebody who praised me and made me really feel good about myself. And a worst boss is usually somebody who lost his or her temper, who's critical, who hovers over you, doesn't believe in you, doesn't give you the time to teach you what you need to do. And think about, with the best boss, you get guilty not to work. You feel guilty not to do your best. And with the worst boss, you think about all kinds of passive-aggressive ways to try to call in sick or to try to get out of doing what you're supposed to do. Children are no different in terms of that. Okay, so that's the basic introduction in terms of the love and limits. Now let me get to tachlis-oriented stuff, and then we'll get a discussion going. Tachlis-oriented stuff. Number one, what kind of consequences work best in terms of limit setting? Okay, point one on that general category is something called, well, doesn't need to be have a name. It's calmness. The key is calmness. The key is not losing your temper. Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz of Kamenetz in pre-Holocaust Europe had a special anger hat. He wouldn't allow himself to give in to his anger at his wife, his children, or his talmidim until he put on this special hat. I once gave a talk where I talked about Rav Baruch Ber's hat, and a direct family member of his came over to me who grew up with him and said, 100% right. This story is 100% true. He had a special anger hat. And he had a temper. He had to work on his temper. So if he felt himself losing it at his children, what would he do? He'd say, wait a second. He'd pull back. He'd go to his closet, rummage through the closet till he found his hat, and then come back after he put on the anger hat. He'd still set the limit. But it was done from a position of calmness. When it's done from a position of calmness, it's much more effective. It's far more effective. Psychologists tell us, there's new neurobiologic research, it goes like this. Goes that if you lose your temper right away, you allow yourself to give in right away to your temper, your kids or whoever, your short neural circuitry, short circuitry right behind your nose, the animal center of the brain, that immediately you give in, and it's very animalistic. They say, the Baltanya says, why is losing your temper kilu oved avodah zarah? It's because you become animalistic when you lose your temper that way. You become animalistic. What do you have to do? They now know that if you just take a few seconds, like your mother's probably taught you, just breathe in easily through your af, through your nose, right? The word af and nose is tied together. The Hebrew word for anger is af. Breathe in calmly. That allows the longer neurologic circuits to travel for you to, they travel to your frontal prefrontal cortex. That's where your thinking brain lives, and it allows you to calm down and process and think things through so that you're far more effective. Interestingly, that's exactly the place that it goes to, is exactly where we put the Shel Rosh on every morning. So you go from the Af to the Shel Rosh. You go from Af to the Shel Rosh. It makes an enormous difference. Story. Listen to this story. I'm in Montreal a number of years ago. And I was talking to a group of teachers about the same thing. What goes for parenting is what goes for chinuch also, for being a teacher, for being a rebbe, for being a mechanechet. So I talk about Rebbe Bear's hat. And there's a lot of research on this. I'm not boring you with the research, but it's called high expressed emotion. Psychologists always know how to make things boring. High levels of expressed emotion. Yelling, screaming, and criticism is associated with the kind of limit setting that almost guarantees your kid's not going to listen to you. Okay? You know? If you respond with anger and criticism, your child is just not going to internalize the limits that you set for them. So I told them about Rebbe Bear's hat. That night, I was giving a parenting talk to the community in Montreal, from community. I'm walking into the hall where the talk was going to be, and waiting for me is the Kita Gimel Rebbe of the local Hasidic Yeshiva in Montreal. And he says he has a story for me. Here's the story he tells me. He said he got back from my lecture that morning a little bit late to his Kita Gimel class, and he walks in to the class, and one of these little pitzels, this little kid, again, little third grade kid, looks at his watch as if to say, hey, Rebbe, you're late. Okay? So he said he wanted to kill. He said, chutzpah, what kind of chutzpah is that? How dare you? How dare you? And he was ready to kill me. He was ready to just go after the kid. And he told me he remembered Rebbe Bear's hat. So he metaphorically put on Rebbe Bear's hat in his head. He imagined putting on Rebbe Bear's hat. And he said, I'll talk to him during recess. Recess comes, and he's about to go to the kid to give him a piece of his mind, give him a muster, but from a calmer place, from the Shel Rosh instead of from the Af, okay? And before he can say anything, the kid comes running over to him and says, Rebbe, look at the watch I got for my birthday. I got a brand new watch, okay? That's the key. Usually, if you just step back and you try to see things through the eyes of the kid, it doesn't mean you don't set the limit. But just think of how disastrous it would have been had he given in to his anger. And what the kid was really doing was showing off his watch, not criticizing the Rebbe. And very often that's the case. And we can only see things through the eyes of the child. It makes an enormous difference. Okay. So that's number one. So number one is you don't want to have what psychologists call harsh startup. Here's a guy, John Mordechai Gottman. John Mordechai Gottman is the leading marital therapist and marital therapy researcher in the country. Some of you may have read about him. He's in Seattle, and his stuff is very respected, especially in the field by psychologists, because it's published in the best journals. He's done incredible research where he's gotten the field of marital therapy down to such a science that he could tell, he'll have a couple come into his office and fight, and he could tell in 7 minutes with 94% accuracy if they'll be divorced in 5 years. Okay. He doesn't then give him the card of a divorce lawyer. He then says, come, we'll work on it, we'll fix it. By the way, his name is John Mordechai Gottman, because about 10 years ago he became a Baal Tshuva. And now, as a big kid of Shashem, he travels around the world with a big yarmulke on his head. Okay, which is very nice. So I'm very proud. Every time I see him at these big conferences, you see this guy who's universally respected walking around with this huge yarmulke. Anyway, makes us look good. So what are the predictors? What are the predictors? Because the predictors of divorce, okay, and don't listen to me too carefully here. Don't worry about it. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a way of thinking about it. One of the predictors is harsh startup, the failure to put on a Baruch Bear's hat. It's one of the predictors. So when you go from 0 to 100 right away, and you start immediately going nuts, he finds that's not so great. He finds it's not so great. He finds that predictor, that's a predictor because usually in a marriage, if you start a disagreement with harsh startup and you don't put on the Baruch Peres hat, right? So you go right away, instead of to the Shel Rosh, you go to the Af, okay? What happens? At that point, it's pretty guaranteed, his research shows, you're going to have a harsh shutdown and things never get fixed. And the research that he shows with marriages, he shows with parenting as well, and with teaching and other research. So it's an enormously important thing. He has other kinds of predictors. He has four main predictors. I won't go over it with you just because of time, but they're interesting, although one of the other predictors is criticism, where when you get angry, it's dominated with criticism, and where you don't show that in spite of everything that you still love the person you're disagreeing with. So those are all partial predictors, and again, we could learn a tremendous amount about parenting. The one other thing I'll talk to you about Dr. Gottman is what he finds about gender differences, because it has real implications for parenting when we talk about the specifics, that now that I'm going into the third and final part of the talk. Listen to this. He finds that most of the time in marriages, the person who brings up the difficult situations are the women, 80% of the time. Now, as he has the couples fight, he has them hooked up to biofeedback equipment, where he measures their physiologic responsivity to stress. And he finds the following incredible difference between the genders. He finds that the average woman, the more she talks about what she's upset about, the more her blood pressure goes down, the more her pulse rate goes down, and the better she feels. The average man, and I guess this is a kal vachomer with the average guy who's a yeshiva guy, okay? The average man, the more he talks about what he's upset about and fighting with his wife, the more his blood pressure goes up, the more his pulse rate goes up, and he stays upset and physiologically aroused in an unpleasant way, feeling sick for hours afterwards. So the very thing that's a refuah for the average woman is the source of the machala for the average man. Okay? Interesting. Now what do you do? True, right? It's true? Yeah, okay. I'm coming from a Shabbos at a Chai Lifeline retreat where families who have children with cancer or other kinds of life-threatening or chronic illnesses get together and they talk. And the difference between men talking and women talking is very, very different. And I spend some time as I meet with people talking about that difference, because it doesn't mean, it's when it comes to limit setting, it probably means that if your husband follows that style, he's going to be the better specialist in dealing with limit setting that involves ignoring. Men are better at ignoring. They're not as likely to be sucked into talking things out. Women are better at doing the limit setting that requires talking. Now, this isn't always the case. There are exceptions. But for the most part, joining together as a team and figuring out the misbehavior, certain misbehaviors call for ignoring. Low-level stuff, a kid fetching, a kid low-level sibling fighting. If you can't handle it and you find yourself getting sucked into it like the average, not all women, but many women, and you could give it over to your husband and you could go into a corner and put your iPod on or whatever it is that you do to get your mind off something, or walk out or go on your cell phone. That's where a cell phone's a good thing. Then let him be the specialist in things dealing with ignoring. When it calls for talking things out, okay, then the likelihood is, in most parents, that women are probably better. They have that better ear. You know, there's a beautiful wisdom in Hebrew language, the Hebrew word ashrei, which is the highest level of happiness. If you look it up in the dictionary, it's bliss. Okay, is tried to the word ishur, which means to license or to validate. When somebody feels validated, okay, it really does lead to higher levels of happiness and better limit setting. They feel you get them and you hear them. Okay, so guideline number one on this section, is calmness, put on a Baruch Bear's hat, go from the Av to the Shul Rosh. Make sense? Step back response. Walk away. Don't deal with it right away. Strike when the iron is cold. Okay? That's guideline number one. Guideline number two is in terms of the limit setting that tends to work best in terms of consequences, short, fair, and logical. Short means that if you have to punish your kid or have some kind of consequence if the kid is old enough for that, short means don't ground them for the rest of their lives. Don't tell them that, you know, whatever it is that you may come up with in terms of a consequence, don't take away privilege for an overly long period of time. Child time is different than adult time. It's much more effective, usually, if the consequences are just a day at a time. That works better. Okay, short. Fair. If they feel that it makes sense, and you talk it out with them, and it makes, that's, you're in charge. Again, that's what I started with, right? Mosif haben ava alaviv, right? I started with that pasuk of Mishlei. But it's if it's logical and it makes sense to the kid, it's going to work much better. Now, how do you do that? How do you figure that out? It's making clear that you're the one in charge, but hearing them out about trying to see things through their eyes. Again, to be understood, first understand. So if there's a recurring issue, your kid's always keeping the room a mess, okay? Nagging's not the answer. Constant criticism's not the answer. It's not going to work, right? When's the last time your kid said, oh, mommy, I didn't think of that. I should pick up my coat when I come in and hang it up and make my bed. I'll do that right away. Thank you so much for pointing that out to me. Kids don't tend to work that way. They do sometimes, but that doesn't necessarily always follow. What does follow, though, is if you find a recurring issue, instead of losing it, have a planned discussion with the kid. Have a planned discussion where you sit down, shut the cell phone off, take the phone off the hook, try to find somebody else to watch the other kids or have your husband watch the other kids if there's no other way to do it. And just sit with them and say, let's talk this out. One more Hebrew thing, because I think there's incredible wisdom you can learn about parenting in the Hebrew language. The word maznayim, which is the scale, has embedded in it what word? Ozen. 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 To hear. Right? The inner ear is where balance lies. There's something very balancing about listening to your kid. Very balancing. It balances them. Hear them out. So let's say the recurring issue is that they're always, I don't know, that your 7-year-old son is always, when you're not looking, kicking your 3-year-old daughter, or whatever it might be, you know, or just to, he gets bored, so he, I don't know, takes away her favorite doll, or whatever it is, okay? So if you see a recurring theme, I'm not saying you shouldn't deal with it right away, that's good, but strike when the iron is cold in terms of the underlying issue. Sit down with this 7-year-old boy and say, come on, let me hear what's going on here. Let's talk about it. Let me hear it through your, let me try to hear it and see it through your eyes. Hear them out. Allow them to discuss about what it is that's annoying to them. Then try to explain exactly why you think it shouldn't continue and then come up with consequences and hear what they think a consequence should be. If you get them actively collaborating with you, you're much more likely to be able to set limits that are gonna make a difference. Okay? So let's summarize. Let me summarize what I've said until now. What I've said until now is, first of all, is the best way to understand limit setting in children is to go back to the Chazal of Smoldochad Mimakareves, the left-right shift, right? Wasserman says it all. You take your child, push them away with the left hand, bring them closer with the right, you turn them around. And with that left-right shift, you're more likely to be able to set limits effectively. That's number one. Number two, it's in terms of limit setting, the fact that your child cries or is upset is fine. And very often they know, not so far from the surface, that it's what's better for them, like the Medrash tells us, right? It's, and like the examples I told you, they know it as long as it's coming from that logical, calm, fair place that makes sense. Okay? When you do deliver the limits, nagging doesn't work, criticism doesn't work, high levels of yelling and screaming doesn't work. It's similar to the Gottman stuff. And what does work is calmly delivering consequences that are short, fair, and logical. Okay? Okay. Now, let me... I think the way I'm going to really make this meaningful is for us to get a discussion going. So let me end with this story. I'll end with the story, and then we'll get a discussion going. If you want, we can talk a little bit about the internet. I'd like to talk about that a little bit. No talk about limit setting is complete without the internet. And what's the story I'm going to tell you? Just censored one. Let me think. What makes most sense? Okay. Okay. Here's the story. Here's the story. Okay. It's a little corny, but I'm going to tell the story. So, I haven't told the story in a long time. Okay. I mean, not corny. It's just a little bit heavy-handed, but I'll do it anyway. Okay. Because it's about planting seeds, and I'm keeping in mind the underlying impetus for tonight. So it's about planting seeds and why I'm so impressed that the response to the death of Yehudaya ben Yeshua Yakir is to have a parenting lecture. So here's the story. Here's the story. It goes like this. I gave a shiur some neighborhood about the works of my main area is trauma, is post-traumatic stress disorders, where my secular hat is traumatic events, you know, whatever. So I've done, well, it's irrelevant to this talk, but I was giving a talk, I think it was after 9/11, about the works of the P.S.S. and the Rebbe, right? He was the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto as it was being liquidated. His works, a Polish construction worker, after the war was doing construction, all these manuscripts fall out. And there was a piece of paper written in the hand of the Rebbe of Shapira saying, whoever finds this and sends it to my brother in Palestine, if you find it, it likely means I'm dead, but our family will reward you for getting this to my brother in Palestine. So they found this in 1946. They get it over to his brother, and unbelievable svarim, you know, the Eish Kodesh. This is the author of Chovas HaTalmidim, the most brilliant book on child psychology ever written. And all of it's been translated into English. His drushes that were given as the Warsaw Ghetto was burning to give chizuf, etc. So I gave a talk, it was a little bit after 9/11, it was in a community that was very directly impacted by that tragedy. And after the talk, a doctor comes over to me and he's crying. Prominent surgeon comes over to me. He's crying. I saw him. What did I do? He said, no, he says, let me tell you something, because I'll tell you what you triggered for me. He says, let me tell you about the P.S.S. and the Rebbe. He says, the P.S.S. and the Rebbe is the reason I'm standing here. He tells the following story. He says, his father, he grew up hearing this story repeatedly. His father was about 13 years old. And he goes to learn in the yeshiva of the P.S.S. and the Rebbe. Very tremendous poverty then, and you'd eat, drink, sleep, and learn in the Beis Medrash. And one night, his father, who's cold and lonely and away from home, obviously, falls asleep on a bench near a window where it's freezing cold. It's the Warsaw, the cold Warsaw winters. And he's freezing. He's freezing. You know, the window's closed, but the chill is coming through. 3 o'clock in the morning, he wakes up, and he sees that the Rebbe, okay, is taking the bench with this young 13-year-old boy on it, bringing it into the center of the Beis Medrash, and he tucks him in. Very nice, very inspiring, but okay, no big deal. I mean, it's a big deal, but it's not such a big deal that I'd end the talk with the Rebbe tucking a kid in. Except what happened 2 years later. 2 years later, the same boy, now age 15, is on the selection line in the concentration camp. He's a smart kid. He sees and he says to himself, he tells his kids as they're growing up, they're sending all the older people, all the short, puny, weak yeshiva bachur. They're going off to the side. They're going to the left. They're going to their deaths. And he's in a state of yish. He realizes that his life is about to end. And he gives up. He's giving up. And they get up to him in the line. And just as they're about to call on him, to select him, he's certain to his death. A Gestapo member of the Gestapo comes in. He says, carpenters, everybody, I need carpenters. Can anybody volunteer to be a carpenter? He tells his kids, I think to myself, I'm a klutzy yeshiva boy. I don't know even how to hammer a nail into a piece of wood. They'll discover I'm a fraud and they'll shoot me immediately. What's the point? Might as well go to my death now. He's again in a state of yish. Then, involuntarily, what flashes through his mind, he doesn't even know why, is the image of 2 years earlier being tucked in by the Rebbe. And he thinks to himself, somewhat implausibly, you know something? I'm worth something. I'm somebody. If the Rebbe, in the middle of his incredibly busy and unbelievable life of doing nonstop chesed, found me worthy to tuck in on a cold winter night, he had his Ruach HaKodesh. The Rebbe was killed that day, by the way. He was killed that day. He says, the Rebbe has Ruach HaKodesh. He must have known if he spent that time that I was going to survive. Without even thinking, he raises his hand. Just in the nick of time, and they choose him to be a carpenter, and his fellow Jews have him sweep the floor. And he tells his children that every time he was at death's door, and he was about to give up because of the relentless torture, the image of being tucked in by the Rebbe would come in and would reinvigorate him. Now, why am I ending with this? Because I've often thought back since I heard this story to that day over 60 years ago. Do you think for even 1 second the Rebbe that day realized that those 30 seconds would have the reverberations they have now over 6 decades later? Beautiful Mamar Chazal. Ma'at min ha'ar docha harbe min ha'choshach. Just a little bit of light pushes away a tremendous amount of darkness. Just a little bit of light pushes away a tremendous amount of darkness. Now think about that little spark lit that morning just by tucking in this kid. Tucking in this kid that evening. Think about it. Today it's a bonfire. Because beyond a shadow of a doubt, that's why this boy survived. Because of a simple tuck. Okay? Beyond the shadow of a doubt, that's why he survived. Beyond the shadow of a doubt, that's why he went on to have a family. And the family's unbelievable. It's a family of doctors. People come from all over to be healed by these children of this young boy. They are incredible B'nai Torah. I know the grandchildren. I knew him. I knew him well. He gave permission for me to tell over this story. I called and wanted to get permission to say over the story. And he said, please, say it over. He died, by the way. His son, who told me the story, who's this Bukhar, was born on the day of his liberation from Auschwitz, and he died on that day, Purim, a few years ago. So, what's the lesson? What's the bottom line? The bottom line is limit setting is a deceptively simple yet deceptively complex issue. Sure, we can talk about the technology, and it's tied to calmness, and it's tied to love, and tied to limits, and tied to all these ways, and we could talk about techniques as the discussion going. But what it's ultimately all about is lighting the sparks by loving your children, by being there. And you never know when just being there for a kid makes an enormous difference. You just never know. And with that optimistic note, okay, let's get a discussion going. Let me hear, and let's make it meaningful in terms of specifics. I'll assume you're talking about your next door neighbor. Okay?
No, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, very common question is the old biting question. Okay? H2? Okay. Okay, the old biting question. Let me hear what people, there's a lot of wisdom in this room. I'll give you, what I'm going to say is going to be incredibly simple and it's not going to be very satisfying. What other people do? What do people do? You've all been through it with your kids. What do you do, and what works, what doesn't work? Huh?
I don't know. I'm trying. A lot of positive reinforcement on the good times or the times when, you know, not
hitting.
And what I just started doing is a lot of, long-term reward, meaning, like, if I hear from your mother that you didn't bite today, we'll get a little something.
And how old is that kid?
He's 2. I just started doing it, so I'm not sure.
Yeah. It's probably, long-term reward for kids so young is probably not going to work. Their sense of time is just not finely developed enough. What probably works best, first of all, kids, it's common, it's normal, and they will outgrow it. All you could really do is a combination of distraction and a sharp no when it happens and not making a big deal out of it. In other words, I don't know, let me hear what's worked for different women in this room.
I feel like when my kids were that young, it wasn't like, yeah, I like to bite and I'm going to bite it.
Yeah.
It usually came from something. So until I got an idea of why it was happening, you just take them out of the situation.
And it usually came from what?
Well, there were different situations, but one would be like, I'm playing next to a kid, that kid is encroaching on my territory and touching my toy. Chomp. That at a certain point, you know, instead of just pulling the kid out after they bite and saying time out for a minute and putting them in either the playpen or, you know, on a chair in the corner for a minute.
They're too young at that age for a timeout anyway. They're too young. Timeout for age 3. Well, that's which would be fine.
Not a real timeout.
Well, you don't have the reality is they're so young. Okay, they're so young that you can't do anything other than deal with it on a, don't see it. See it as a normal behavior. Say this is what a kid this age does for a living. I've never spoken to an audience where a woman has raised this question, and people say, wow, I never heard that before. It's a very common issue. Kids go through that stage. It's part of what kids do. It's oral aggression. It's part of the way they explore the world at that age is through their mouth. Huh? It's the way they communicate. They can't talk, so they use the logic. They can't use the logic of words. And they all outgrow it. And the key is, not to make a big deal out of it. In other words, like, you just, you know, a sharp no and a distraction is more than enough. And eventually, it stops. And the main thing is to tell yourself, okay, once, it's really nothing to be concerned about.
My husband, when we were looking at our dissolve, my daughter was tight. She was our first, she was like 2 or something. And my husband went over to her mobile. And he said, what should I do? My daughter's biting. She didn't really know. Why is she biting? He said, there are kids taking his toys away. So she's biting. So he said, tell them not to take his toys away.
That's great. Yeah. That's right. And that's the collective wisdom in the room is you always look at antecedents. You know, if somebody comes to mind, let's say this was a really serious issue in a family where it was really becoming a real problem. Sometimes that happens. There's a kid who's in a preschool program where the kid's doing a lot of biting and the teachers are getting nuts and the mother has to work and there's no alternatives. And it becomes a real issue. What a psychologist does is you look at it, it's ABCs, antecedents, behavior, consequences. What's happening before, what the behavior is, and what the consequences are in the preschool, let's say. The key here is antecedents. What's leading up to it? Once you understand what's happening, here you can't rely on the kid to stop because the kid doesn't have the words to be able to stop. You know, what happens if you're driving on 95 or on the local, expressway, and a big truck driver and a huge Mack truck cuts you off, what stops you from chasing, especially if you see him guzzling a beer? Why don't you chase him? It's because you talk to yourself. You say, look, if I go after him, he's bigger than me, he's stronger than me, his truck could squash my little car like a bug, okay? It's words. Little kids can't do that. So you're going to have tantrums when they're that young, and you're going to have biting when they're really young. And so it becomes our job to, like Revolpa said so brilliantly, as he always said, he got right to the heart of it. He says, oh, okay, you know, get rid of the antecedent, you know.
Biting something that's not appropriate to bite to
You could. You could. That's another. Redirection is a variation on the theme of just of distraction. It's a redirection. Yeah, you're right. No, it's right. If the kid, it depends on why the kid is biting. So redirect.